Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is Pico Iyer. He's made more than 100 retreats over the past three decades to a small Benedictine hermitage high above the sea in Big Sur, California. He's not a Christian or a member of any religious group, but his life has been transformed by these periods of time spent in silence. In his new book, A Flame, he meditates about the power of silence and what it can teach us about how to live, how to love, and ultimately, how to die. Pico Iyer is author of 15 books, translated into 23 languages. He's been a constant contributor for more than 30 years to Time, New York Times, Harper's Magazine, Los Angeles Times, more than 250 other periodicals worldwide. His four recent talks for TED have received more than 11 million views. Pico Iyer, a pleasure to welcome you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I'm so happy to be here.
So I understand you're speaking to me from Santa Barbara. So what's the situation there? Thankfully, no fires there in Santa Barbara.
Thankfully, no fires for now. I flew back from Japan 3 days ago, and my electricity has been off almost ever since, just in case there might be a fire, because these are perfect fire conditions. But so far, we're much more fortunate than our neighbors down in Los Angeles.
Just a horrible situation there. Reading the latest here of death toll right now is at 24. The tragic, so many homes burned down. And unfortunately, forecast is for strong winds early part of this week. So our prayers certainly go out to those folks in the Los Angeles area. Unfortunately, Pico Iyer, you can relate to some of the people who've lost their homes. This was several years ago. Your house burned down.
Yes, I mean, I can see it as if it were yesterday. I was in my family home here in the hills in Santa Barbara, and I went upstairs and I saw that our whole house was encircled by 70-foot flames. So I grabbed my mother's cat, I ran out to the car, we drove down our narrow mountain driveway, and then we saw we couldn't go up and we couldn't go down. The smoke was so thick we could hear helicopters above, but we couldn't see them and they couldn't see us. And the fire was so everywhere that the fire trucks couldn't get up to us. And so we were actually stuck in the middle of the fire for 3 hours. And the only thing that saved us was a good Samaritan who had been driving along the freeway in his water truck. And he saw a fire break out in the hills, so he drove up to be of help. And he ended up stranded by chance just next to our driveway. And so when we pulled down the driveway, there he was in his shorts, shirtless, with a hose. And every time the fire approached him, he just pointed the hose towards the fire and it receded. And then he turned around and pointed it in the other direction. And really, by saving his life, he saved ours too.
And this seems small in comparison, but you lost notes for, a book or two.
Well, I lost literally everything in the world, but yes, because I'm a writer, and those were almost pre-computer days, so all my notes were handwritten, and I really lost my next 8 years of writing my next three books. And when finally a fire truck could get up to us and tell me that it was safe to drive downtown, I went to an all-night supermarket, and I bought a toothbrush, and literally, that toothbrush was the only thing I had to start my new life.
Before we go on, what are your thoughts about the folks in the greater Los Angeles area, just facing these fires, which it seem to just continue?
They do. Of course, my heart goes out to them. And of course, fires are so much more frequent now than when I lost my house. I think the one thing I found as the years moved on is that although the fire that stripped us of everything was a big turning point in our life, it wasn't entirely a disaster. And as the months and years went on, I found that in certain ways it opened doors, even though it had closed so many, and that it gave me a chance to live afresh, to start anew, and maybe to live a little more closely to the way I'd always wanted to live. And one thing that's striking, you mentioned in your generous introduction how I have written for Time magazine for 40 years. And my job in those days was to be a columnist for Time magazine. And so as soon as I drove out of the fire, I went to the supermarket, I bought a toothbrush, and I came to a friend's house to sleep on the floor. But before I went to sleep, I went to my friend's computer to file an article for Time magazine. And that very night, so the evening when I lost everything in the world, I wrote an article about the fire And I ended it with a poem that I'd picked up in Japan from, I think, the 17th century, in which somebody wrote, "My house burnt down. I can now see better the rising moon." So the very night I lost everything, something in me, probably wiser than I am, sensed that it wasn't only a loss and that maybe I could get a clearer sense of priority and proportion from this, and that maybe there was something to be gained as well.
That's good perspective, and hopefully they get these fires under control, and loss of life will be limited. In fact, if your house burned down, understand, because of insurance rules, you had to rebuild at the same place, and decreasing fires, you've had to flee fires several times since then.
Exactly. I mean, I think living in the hills of California, we know we're probably living where humans were never meant to live, and that these hills can't survive without fire. So our job is to see how we can live with fire, because it's an omnipresent threat. And as you say, we were more or less obliged through the financial settlement to rebuild where we had been before. And for many years thereafter, whenever friends visited our house, as soon as they opened the front door, they were greeted by six packed suitcases. So my mother put all her new photographs and papers in suitcases so we'd be ready to run away as soon as we received a reverse 911 call. And just as you say, we probably have evacuated the new house 10 or 12 times. And so we're always living with this very acute sense of uncertainty, which also, I think, makes us cherish every moment and be grateful for the times like now when things are relatively calm where we are.
You talk about climate change as well in the book. And so not only more frequent fires, more intense fires that we're seeing, but also tsunamis and hurricanes and floods, et cetera. What you learn about uncertainty, you say. What else do we learn from all of this, do you think?
I think we learn how small we are. You know, when I was a kid, I thought, I make my own destiny. I can make a plan, I can write my next three books, and I can make my way in the world. And the older I've grown, the more I've been humbled. And I think that's a good thing in some ways. I'm reminded I'm at the mercy of the heavens, whether, as you say, it's the winds or the floods or whatever. For the last 2 years here in California, we had very torrential winter storms. So for once, we weren't worried about fire, but there would literally come broadcasts through our house in the dead of night talking about flash floods and saying that if we left our houses, we'd risk death. And as you say, I think pretty much everybody in the world is in this state. So it means, as with the pandemic, we're all in the same boat. And really, those people in California and Utah are probably relatively fortunate compared to the millions in Haiti and the Philippines and Turkey who have to deal with natural cataclysms and don't always have our resources. As you know, in my book, I mention at one moment when, as you say, we had to flee our rebuilt house. And I was staying in a friend's house, and every morning when I walked out, I didn't know whether to look up at the hills where our house was meant to be or not to look up, because maybe our house wouldn't be there. So we were staying in this state of absolute uncertainty. And at the same time, the hermitage, the Benedictine monastery where I often go, was also 3 hours up the coast, encircled by fire too. So my seeming sanctuary was imperiled also. And I was thinking, what can I do now? And I remembered that there was a Christian Anglican retreat house in my hometown, just 15 minutes away. So I got in my car and I drove up to the top of the mountain and I sat in the monastery garden and I felt this absolute sense of calm and clarity. And I could look out over the ocean and I could see the big DC-10s flying over to drop retardant on the fire. And going to that garden was the perfect solace and medicine, and it just reminded me of what outlasts our hopes, and it really gave me a great sense of calm. 5 months later, that local monastery to which I had retreated burnt down too. So in some ways, there is that we all know nowhere is safe, nobody is immune, and there are no guarantees.
The Slate's Book of Flame was based on notes over, I think, many years. So why did you decide to publish this now?
I think for three reasons. The first is I do feel that our world is accelerating more furiously than ever. We're almost living at this post-human pace, and I don't think humans were ever meant to live at a pace determined by machines. And I think what so many of us are crying out for is a chance just to live again more slowly at a human pace with time to remember what's really essential in our lives. And so to go on retreat and to be in a place without cell phones and internet and distractions suddenly is a great luxury now, in the way it wasn't even when I first began going to this hermitage 33 years ago. And I think the other two reasons why now seemed the time to bring all my notes together was that I've never seen the world so divided as it is currently. And I've never seen my friends so despairing. And I think the divisions in the world are often because our beliefs and our words set us apart. If you and I were to talk for a few hours, we might find politically or religiously or in other ways, you and I think differently. But when we're joined in a moment of silence, we're really joined into a larger community beyond our words and our beliefs. And silence, I think, it is a place beyond argument and beyond division to some extent. Anybody who goes to church knows that part of what a church offers is the silence where you're not quibbling about this and that, you're joined in something larger. And when it comes to despair, I thought, as a writer, how can I offer hope and light to people? And I haven't found anywhere on earth that has offered me so much inspiration and consolation as this little group of 15 monks living in the remote wilderness with such a sense of conviction and clarity and kindness. And they have become really the light in my life, and therefore something I want to share with others who are looking for light.
When you first went there, what were you looking for? Has that changed over time?
It's certainly evolved. When I first went there, it was partly because I was sleeping on the friend's floor after the fire, and another friend saw me there and said, "Come on, Pico, you can do better than this." And he told me about this retreat house to which he took his high school students every year. And he said, "Well, if nothing else, you'll have a bed to sleep in and a long desk and a private walled garden with a beautiful view over the Pacific Ocean and hot showers, all the food you could want, just for $30 a night. So you'll be doing better than sleeping on the floor." And so that's what initially took me there. And I'm an only child, and as a writer, I spend much of my life alone, so I love being alone. And so to be alone in this heavenly setting, looking out over the radiant Pacific Ocean with the silence thrumming all around me and rabbits on the splintered fence beside me, was heavenly indeed, was paradisal. But the longer I stayed there, as you said in your introduction, the more I saw that being alone in that beautiful setting was just a means to learning how better to be a member of the community and how to release more compassion towards the people around me. Because these Benedictine monks were so selflessly opening their doors and their hearts to everybody of any religion or no religion at all. And they had devoted their lives to service. And it was so moving to see them work around the clock to look after one another and to take care of guests such as myself. And as the years went on, and I've stayed there more than 100 times over 33 years, sometimes when all the 15 retreat rooms were full, the monks would invite me to come and stay with them in their cloister or enclosure. And when I stayed with them, I found that their lives, of course, were not peaceful and calm because they're working round the clock, cooking food, taking care of accounts, fixing generators, looking after residents. And it was a very humbling exercise in just seeing charity at work and people who've devoted their lives to service. And so what initially was for me a wonderful escape from the distractions of the world and chance to be alone in a glorious setting became really a lesson in how to think more about other people and how, when I came down from the mountain, to try to give myself more fully to the people in my life.
Tell me a little bit more about some of these monks. They weren't what I expected. I guess I had the stereotype of a monk in my mind.
I had all the stereotypes of monks in my mind too. And one of the beauties of going there was to free me from some of my preconceptions. Firstly, I found that they were the opposite of dogmatic. They're much less dogmatic than I. They're very, very open-minded. They're part of the Camaldolese congregation, which is the most contemplative congregation within the Catholic Church. And they actually, you know, some of my monk friends go and teach at the Zen center across the hills. They have a Catholic Hindu ashram in southern India where the priest actually wears an Indian dhoti and sleeps on the floor and eats with his hands. And the motto of their Catholic ashram in India is, we are here to awaken from the illusion of separateness. We are here really to see everything we have in common. And that's the life they are consecrated to. And of course, one of the other surprises I found, they're extremely gregarious. They're very down to earth, much more down to earth than visitors like myself, and extremely talented. Some are scholars, some are painters whose work you will see in greeting card stores across the nation. Some are semi-professional musicians. Each one of them has a very distinct skill, and it's really been a privilege both to spend time with them and to see what sacrifices they've made in giving their lives to this monastery. And as you know, later in the book, I describe at one point driving up into the high, cold, dark mountains behind Los Angeles and meeting Leonard Cohen, the great singer and poet, when he was living as a monk for 5.5 years. And it really made an impression on me that Leonard Cohen, at the age of 61, who had been a celebrated writer and singer for 30 years at that time, who could be doing anything he wanted in the world, had chosen to give himself to this very rigorous monastic discipline. And he told me, having sampled all the pleasures of the world, this is the real delicious and voluptuous and profound entertainment. This is the great adventure in life, going inwards, finding out what really matters, remembering what you care for, getting away from often the less exalted concerns of the world to something much deeper, closer to your soul. So, as you suggest, the monks are always surprising and always exist far beyond our ideas of them. And when I stay with them, it's fun because they're so warm and they're so full of teasing. I remember once I was saying that I was a little afraid because there were mountain lions on the property. And one of the monks said, oh, if you see a mountain lion, just make sure you don't look like a deer. Or one of the monks would say to me, hey, Pico, how are you doing? I said, really well. He said, don't worry, we can take care of that. So they're wonderfully warm-hearted as well as open-hearted souls.
If you just joined us, we're talking with the writer Pico Iyer, and his new book is called A Flame. Subtitle is Learning from Silence, and we'll talk much more about this following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're pleased to have with us the writer Pico Iyer. He's made more than 100 retreats over the past 3 decades to a small Benedictine hermitage high above the sea in Big Sur, California. And in his new book, A Flame, he meditates about the power of silence, what it can teach us about how to live, how to love, and ultimately how to die. That is out, I think, publishing today. A Flame, Learning from Silence. So, Pico Iyer, I was reading an interview you gave. You were talking about how your last book and this one are connected. Of course, the previous book, The Half-Known Life. And you were saying, I just want to quote you from this interview. You were talking about Half-Known Life was kind of, you talked about that we as humanity have gone through a big experience, the pandemic at that point. And we had a choice, you say, at that point, whether we would concentrate on everything we shared, which was a huge amount emotionally, or whether we would concentrate on what we didn't share, which had to do with our political, religious, or ideological differences. And I, if I'm answering that question, I think we opted for the latter, at least among my group, opted to lean on the divisions. What are the one of the things you were trying to do, I think, with the Half-Known Life is bridge those divisions, help us to come together. So with the new book, what are some of the main questions that you're treating?
Exactly, Tom. I'm glad you brought those 2 points together, and I'm glad you really highlighted the point of my book, which is that to go to a place where people who have committed themselves to a different faith from my own are so ready to look after me and encourage me to find what is deepest inside me and open their doors to everybody is a beautiful example of people being able to look beyond their own assumptions towards humanity as a whole. And I think in some ways I feel that what we believe can be less important than how we act. And of course our actions come from our beliefs. But I have friends who share my beliefs and they act in ways that are shocking to me. And I have other friends, like my Benedictine monk friends, whose fundamental beliefs are different from mine, but whose actions are so moving and inspiring that all I want to do is learn from them. And as you were suggesting, I think, this is the time to learn from people whose assumptions may be different from ours, but whose actions are more heroic than ours. And it, for example, during the forest fire, like the one I encountered, first responders and firefighters instantly and instinctively respond to look after people. And they're not asking you, are you from a red state or a blue state? Are you a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu? They're just responding to the humanity within everybody, really. In the same way that if you and I are walking down the street and you see somebody fall down, you'll reach out a hand, again, without asking, did you vote Democrat or Republican? Are you a Muslim or atheist? We're just reaching out to that other person. So every one of us has the capacity to respond to the humanity in others. But will we choose to harden ourselves behind our beliefs, or will we choose to think about our common humanity? And I think these monks, like monks in every tradition, really move me by extending themselves to everybody. You probably know I've spent 50 years with the Dalai Lama, talking and traveling with him constantly. And he's another example of that. He's so deep within his tradition, he's eager to learn from everybody else. And as a committed Buddhist, he gives long talks on the Gospels to Christians in England, and tears come to his eyes when he discusses and thinks about some of the parables of Jesus. People who really spiritual are not making divisions, but they're thinking about how we can get beyond those divisions.
You've talked about how the Dalai Lama, I think every day he prays for who he calls his Chinese brothers and sisters, some of whom are the government, which has pretty much subsumed his home country of Tibet. Tell me about that. And you muse that probably the Chinese government members are not praying for the Dalai Lama.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, Tom, because that's a perfect example. There's an example of selflessness, of turning the other cheek, of loving your neighbor as yourself, even if your neighbor is hostile to you. I mean, the Dalai Lama is essentially living out all Jesus's teachings in that. And as you say, it was the Chinese army that forced him out of his home, that's kept him away from his home for 65 years, that calls him a devil in monk's clothing and a wolf. And yet every morning he wakes up and he prays for them. And of course, there are so many Christians who are in exactly the same position, who are praying on behalf of the people who look to be their enemies. And I think that is the only way we'll begin to get past our divisions. And the Dalai Lama wonderfully and repeatedly says, well, the people you think of as my enemies, the Chinese government, are in some ways my greatest friends, because they're the ones who have taught me the most about learning forgiveness and patience and universality. He tells often a great story about a Tibetan monk who had been imprisoned by the Chinese. And when finally the monk was released, he came out to northern India, where the Dalai Lama lives. And the Dalai Lama asked him, were you ever afraid in all those years when you were being tortured in prison? And the monk said, yes, there was one moment when I was really scared that I would lose my compassion for the Chinese. That's what I was frightened of, that the pain was so much I would stop loving every other member of humanity. And that's the kind of story that really shakes me, that degree of instinctive thinking about everybody as united. And that's also, as I say, very much the spirit I found among my Catholic monks. And when I walk down the street here in Santa Barbara, I think many of us know that's the way to be, but it's often very hard to practice it. So I'm very moved by those monks and nuns who are giving us an example of how to think beyond our divisions. And as you said about stereotypes, my stereotype before I went up there is, oh, a Catholic monk is going to insist on Catholicism as the only way, and a Buddhist monk is going to tell me I have to be a Buddhist. And of course, when the Dalai Lama comes to Utah or California, he tells us not to be Buddhists, to stay within our own traditions and to look after our own community.
You've said, Coach, here, the real question is not how do we get on with everyone we agree with, but how do we get on with the many with whom we disagree? How do we do that?
I think many people have pointed out that even those people we disagree with, let's say politically, we agree with at a human level 99%. And, you know, I've spent 50 years traveling the world, and I find that whenever I'm sitting here in California and I'm thinking about, let's say, Iran, I think about everything that makes it very different from the world I know. It's an Islamic theocratic regime that is pledged politically to be an enemy to the United States. But as soon as I get off the plane in Tehran and get into a taxi, the taxi driver sounds just like a taxi driver in Santa Barbara. He's worried about his kids. He's fretting about the economy. He's extending himself to a stranger, me. And I'm suddenly brought back to this human reality. And I think when we think of other people in our heads, when we think of other places, we think of everything that's different about them. And as soon as we meet them in the flesh, we're reminded of how much we share. Because I think whoever you are, whichever side of the political divide you sit on, your first concern probably is as a parent, as a child, as a spouse, as somebody struggling to make a living and hoping to be healthy. And we have all of that in common. And it's occasionally the sort of names and explanations we put on the world that tear us apart. But I don't think it's that hard to be reminded of what we all share. And that's why I have great faith in silence. When we've all been through a catastrophe and we're joined together in a moment of silence, I'm sure everybody has experienced, let's say, 200 people in a room not saying anything and really feeling part of this larger body and being held up by that larger body and being brought to the deepest part of themselves where they're not thinking of me and you, they're thinking of we or us. And that's why I think religions across the world try to bring us towards silence, because it brooks no argument. It's on the far side of our divisions.
Could you tell me a bit about the experience? You drive to Big Sur, you go to the monastery, usually stay for a few days, right? And you've said that silence is not just an absence of noise, but it's a positive presence. Tell me about what you experience.
Exactly. You put your finger on it, that the silence in a monastery and a convent is not just like being in a quiet place in a forest or on top of a mountain. It's something positive. It's almost like these glass transparent walls that have been constructed by years and years of prayer or meditation. And so when I get out of my car at the top of the mountain and I step into that silence, it's almost pulsing, it's vibrating. It's not an absence, as you said. It awakens me to all the things that I sleepwalk past in the rest of my life. And in this case, when I step into my little room, what the monks are affording every visitor is the chance to do anything or nothing at all. As I say, there are no rules. You can talk if you want. You can walk along the monastery road and talk to friends or seek spiritual counsel from a monk. Otherwise, you can read, you can look at the light over the water, or as I say, you can do nothing. And I sometimes think it's only by doing nothing that we can do anything at all, because most of us are in such a rush in our daily lives. We never have a chance to see the larger picture and to remember what we really care about. We're racing from the bank to the grocery store to the pharmacy. And I think these days, with so many distractions in the world, we're often in such a hurry, we can't see what a hurry we're in. And so I find I need to do something quite dramatic and radical to break through that vicious cycle. And as soon as I step into silence, all the important things rise to the top. I suddenly think about what I need to do with my mother. It was while I was in silence, I decided to marry my longtime sweetheart in Japan. Silence is a place where I trust myself to make the best decisions, because it's not necessarily me that's making them, but it feels as if something wiser than me is in the air. When I'm driving along the road here in California, I think most of the decisions I make are probably wrong ones. And so, as you say, the silence is something almost tangible, and it's what the monks and elsewhere nuns have worked so hard to create. Because I've stayed in monastic institutions in Western Australia and England and Japan, and this last summer I was in New Mexico at the Christ in the Desert Monastery, and every one of them shares the same capacity. It suddenly liberates you from your agitation and thoughts and brings you to some deeper self. It's interesting, you know, Tom, every time I make that drive up the coast towards the Hermitage, as usual, when I drive up there, I'm conducting arguments with myself, and I'm fretting over my deadlines, and I'm worried about what my boss just told me. And truly, as soon as I step into that silence, all of that falls away. It's as if Pico and all his little worries are left down on the highway, and I'm released into something much larger and more expansive. And I think that's what we're all craving, in some ways, to step out of time and into eternity. And it's what we find at moments in our life, if we're deeply in love, or if we have a moment of wonder, or if we're in a place of great beauty, we're suddenly released from ourselves and we're reminded of something so much vaster than we are. And I think that's what we crave, and that's what sustains us often. And I'm so grateful to have found it repeatedly and reliably among these monks.
It's interesting to read this and to hear you talk about this, because I think I probably had a stereotyped image of Pico Iyer, that you're calm all the time, and very zen all the time, but you're like the rest of us, I guess. You need these periods of solitude.
Yeah, well, thank you for such a generous assumption, Tom. Yes, we all need these moments of solitude. And when I travel with the Dalai Lama, one of the most moving things is that I spend all day with him, and I'm 22 years younger than he is. And he never stops for 8 hours during his official day, from 8:30 in the morning to 4:30 in the afternoon. He never takes a break. And often his hosts will say, "Oh, Your Holiness, do you just want to have lunch quietly by yourself, or do you want to take 15 minutes off?" "No, no, no, we must be together." And I'm exhausted just watching him go through his day. And then I remember that every morning when I'm greedily helping myself to food at the buffet in the hotel restaurant and enjoying my beauty sleep, every morning he wakes up at 3:30, even when on the road, and spends his first 4 hours meditating. And so that's how he gathers the strength and the clarity, and in fact, the calm, because there's a perfect example. We always think of the Dalai Lama as so calm and full of laughter and smiles, which he is. But I think it's partly because he's meditating 4 hours a day. And I sometimes think he's the busiest person I know. And if the busiest person I know can give himself every day to 4 hours of meditation, I could probably afford to spend just 20 minutes being quiet every morning. That's not a difficult thing to do, and I'm sure it would make me calmer and clearer through the day. But if you very kind of you to associate me with calm, and if you do, maybe it's because I've been lucky enough to make these 100 retreats and sometimes stay for 3 weeks on end in the midst of this silence and these very inspiring Catholic monks.
What would you, so you spend at least 20 minutes a day, or at least that's your hope, right? You take these occasional retreats. What would you suggest for us to find the benefits of silence and solitude?
Thank you. I mean, it's such an essential question. I would say take a walk. Sit for 20 minutes every morning without your devices. That's only 3% of your day, but I think it transforms the other 97% of the day. In my case, sometimes in the evenings, I'm waiting for my wife to return from her work. And I don't know if I'm going to wait for 20 minutes or 70 minutes. And so I used to kill the time. You know, I'd scroll through the internet, or I'd turn on the TV. There's never anything worth watching on Japanese TV. And then one day I thought, no, let me just turn off the lights and listen to some music. Very calm music, but sometimes not so calm music. And it was amazing, just by disabling most of my senses and sitting quietly in my room listening to music, I felt so much fresher when I heard her key in the door, and I slept much better, and I was much less jangled when I woke up the next morning. And I realized, instead of killing time, I was really restoring time. And I know that as the world is moving so quickly now, almost everybody I know takes a run every day or swims, or maybe she practices yoga or has a meditation practice. We're all doing things to try to open up space in our head and in our days. But I think the more the world speeds up, the more we have to do it. And the wonderful thing is, it's available to just about everybody, and it's non-denominational. I remember during the pandemic, when we were all living in a state of great fear, I was giving a talk to a hospice association, and at the end of the talk, they said, "Can you give us any advice?" And I'm sure they were expecting something lofty and exalted. And I said, "Take a walk. Whatever is going on in your life, I suspect taking a 20-minute walk will bring you back a different and a much clearer and happier person."
If you just joined us, we're talking with Pico Iyer, the writer. His latest book is called A Flame, Learning from Silence. And we'll take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Pico Iyer following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and I'm talking with writer Pico Iyer. He talks about his retreats. He's made over 100 retreats in the past 3 decades to a small Benedictine hermitage high above the sea in Big Sur, California. And in his new book, A Flame, Learning from Silence, he meditates about the power of silence, what it can teach us about how to live, how to love, and ultimately how to die. So, Pico Iyer, while you were writing this book, a lot of things were happening in your life, chaotic things, painful things, even. So your father had died, you were taking care of your mother who was ill, your daughter was struggling with a bout of cancer, fires were encircling your family home. So how do you juxtapose that? How did you get the strength to deal with all of that through these periods of silence and solitude?
Yes, exactly as you say. I was probably going through a version of what almost everybody goes through. You know, reality makes a house call so often in all our lives. And so, for example, when my father quite suddenly went into hospital and died at the age of 65, as you say, it was a very, very busy time. As an only child, I had to look after my mother, and I had to take care of all the funeral arrangements and write the obituary and deal with all the condolence calls and inform all friends and family across the globe. But at one point, on a day when I knew my mother was being well taken care of, I thought the only way really to put this in perspective is to seek out that silence that I found. So I got in my car, I drove 3.5 hours up north to where the hermitage sits, and I just sat on one of the benches above the ocean, hearing the ocean down below me, hearing bells occasionally tolling down the road, and just being reminded of something that really seems to last, that's far bigger and more enduring than I am, the ocean, the silence, this 1,000-year-old practice that the Catholic, that the monks have been observing. And somehow reminding myself of what outlasts our hopes and outlasts our lives was just the medicine I needed. So I just sat there for 2 hours, and then I drove all the 4 hours back. And it probably might sound wishy-washy to people, but it was amazing what sort of useful medicine it offered me. Suddenly, it gave me the larger picture. I find often we're running so quickly from place to place that we can't really see the larger picture. You know, the ancient Greeks said that there are two kinds of time. One is chronos, which is the time defined by clocks and calendars, but one is kairos, which is sacred time, those moments when we're outside the world of time. And I think it's by stepping into kairos that we do justice to chronos. And in this case, by stepping out of the busy world just for a few hours, I was better able to step back into it. And so it's a small example of how, given, as you say, that all of us are going to have to deal with many things, how silence can be of help. I think my question for myself always is, what do I have to bring to the ICU? When my loved ones or when I am suddenly in the intensive care unit, what's going to help me there? And I remember much later, but I think this is during the time I was staying with the monks, suddenly, my mother had a stroke, and she was in the ICU, teetering between life and death for 35 days. So I was sitting by her bedside in the hospital. And as I sat there, I thought, really, my bank account is going to help a little, but not much. My resume, useless. All the books I've written, they're not really much help to me in this critical urgent moment. The only thing I can bring to my mother and to myself at this difficult time is, I thought, what I'd gained in my inner savings account, my inner resources. In other words, probably what I'd developed by sitting quietly alone. All the time I'd spent rushing around and decorating my CV were irrelevant in that moment of crisis. But the times I had spent sitting calmly, thinking about the larger picture and what really matters, were probably all that I had to bring to that moment. And since all of us have to face those moments, all of us have to face the question of what can we bring to them.
You've said that solitude can be a training for community and companionship. You've been talking about that here. Those two seem to be on surface in conflict. Tell me about that. Solitude can be a training for community and companionship.
So it's interesting, as I've been saying, I've always loved being alone, and I loved going to this place of great aloneness. But it was being there that reminded me first that I'm never alone, because when I was there, my friends and loved ones and family were closer to me sometimes than when they're in the same room. And it was being there that actually moved me to decide to get married. You know, I think if I'd just been caught up in the distraction and rush of daily life, I never would have been able to separate myself enough from it to realize I should get married. I should bring something to this person I care about so much and to her children. And so it was soon after I began spending time in the Hermitage that I did make a full-time commitment to my now wife, with whom I've been for 37 years, and my two stepchildren, who now are my children. And that, again, was not exactly what I expected. I thought going to this solitary place, it will just remind me how wonderful solitude is. But as I watched the monks who were living in this solitary location as a means to being better friends to the world, I realized that, as you say, solitude was just a gateway to a deeper sense of community. And silence was just a gateway to a more meaningful kind of speech. And as you suggested earlier in your question, not everybody has the time and resources to go for 3 days on retreat. But if you can't manage that, I'm sure you can still manage a long walk this afternoon in the natural beauty around you, especially if you're in Utah, or go and see a friend without your cell phone on you. Find some way just to come back to your best self.
You've talked about media. Of course, you're a member of the media in a way. And you know, the media is about the present, is about the immediate, sometimes play up the drama, right? That's what sells. Although I will say a lot of outlets are covering the fires in California very, very well. That is immediate, right? That's how to cover it. But I guess what would your suggestion be on consuming media? We want to know what's going on, but you can sure get sucked into the worst pieces of life.
Yes, exactly. So during the pandemic, I made a rule for myself that I would never consume more than 5 minutes of media a day, but ideally 2 minutes. Of course, it was tragic then that the hospitals in Iran were full and that there were no room in the morgues in Bolivia, say. But I felt that the more I listened to the media, the more I felt hopeless and powerless and depressed. And the more that I looked out the window at this radiant spring afternoon in California or took a walk, the more flooded with hope and possibility I was. And so I thought every morning I have a choice. Will I look at what opens me up, which I think is the beautiful world around us, or will I look at what cuts me up, which is too often the media landscape? And as you say, I say this as a member of the mainstream media who's been working for Time Magazine and the New York Times for 42 years, and working with them for such a long time, I know, as you say, that they're always going to concentrate on the dramatic. And the dramatic often is the exceptional. It's when something terrible happens. And all the unterrible, often wonderful things that happen moment by moment seldom figure in the news. And I don't want to forget that. And I don't want to concentrate only on the aberrations in our daytime. So to this day, I try to take in very little media. And as you say, with the fires in Los Angeles, such a shocking thing. We need to know about them. But we probably don't need 4 hours of commentary on them. We just need to know the essentials, which we can get probably in a few minutes. And the media now, unlike when I began in 1982, is mostly filled with predictions, analyses, opinions. And I feel that whether it's the war in Ukraine or the fires in Los Angeles, I need to know what's happening, but I don't need to fill my head with strangers' opinions this way and that way about what I should make of it.
This is not directly related to a flame, but I found it very interesting. I was watching one of your TED Talks. I think it was the one on solitude. And you talked about how when you became a travel writer that you loved to travel, loved to explore, and that you found a way to merge your livelihood with with your joy. Well, then after a while, those two kind of went in opposite directions. And then now, you used to go out in the world, and now the adventure is at your desk. Why don't you talk a bit about that journey? We all go on these interesting journeys. We end up in places where we didn't expect to end up.
Yes, and I think that came home to many of us again during the pandemic. During the pandemic, I couldn't travel as I usually do. I was mostly stranded in my mother's house here. So I started taking walks along the road behind my mother's house. And I would look at the ocean in the distance and the sun rising behind the mountains and think, wait a minute, this road on which my mother lives and where I've been spending 50 years of my life is actually just as beautiful as Rio de Janeiro or Cape Town or Capri or the places I would fly across the world to see. And until the pandemic necessitated it, I'd never walked to the end of my road, 20 minutes away, until in the 50 years my parents had been there. So that reminded me that you don't have to go very far to be transformed. And also, I think when I was a little boy, I thought there are two things I need to know. I want to know about the rest of the world, and so I will try to see it firsthand. But I also need to know about myself and to learn about myself and how to lead the best and most conscience-directed life. I have to be in one place. I can't really think clearly when I'm in movement. So I think it's important all of us try to find that balance between movement and stillness. And neither really makes sense without the other.
I want to end here talking about coming out from the silence. Just a couple of minutes here. What happens when you come back from one of these retreats? What
well,
do you think?
It's often it's a big shock to the system. Mm. And if I stay for 3 days in silence, my first 1.5 days back home, I'm walking on air, and I'm a much nicer version of myself. And then soon I'm back in the rush hour traffic, fretting about my tax return or cursing at the next driver. So it doesn't last forever by any means. But I think cumulatively, over the years, it has created a kind of, as I say, a savings account inside myself that I feel that I can draw upon. So although it never transforms me entirely, my hope is that over the course of now half a lifetime, it will have put me in a different direction. And to go back to your earlier question, I think at some point, staying with the monks, I saw that it was almost as if there was a fork in the road, and success, as I'd seen it as a little boy, getting a great career in the world, lay in one direction, and joy lay in the other. And I realized if there's a choice between success and joy, I would always want to choose joy. And the monks explained to me that joy is the happiness that doesn't depend on circumstance. So that's why the Dalai Lama, who led such a difficult life, is always radiating smiles. And that's why these monks, who are often encircled by fire, remain absolutely confident and cheerful. Even when their lives are difficult, because all lives are difficult, they're still exuding both kindness and optimism. So seeing that example, I think, well, I would like to learn from them.
We'll reach the end of our hour. Thank you so much. Pico Iyer, author of 15 books. The latest just out is called A Flame, Learning from Silence. Pico Iyer, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.